these traditions that we are introducing to Tisarana, like the first time we did the chanting, it sounded probably, you wouldn't want to do a CD of that. But it is kind of lovely just to make an attempt at the traditions and etiquettes which maybe, or chanting that we're not used to, and just keep working on it and see how we're doing something which isn't individually expressed, it's communally expressed. So it's not, it's something that, it's a kind of corporate activity, which is what Sangha is about. And the fact that we, like if you were trying to win a gold medal in the Olympics, you know, it's always got individuality, but here, with our chanting, we're trying to chant as a group. So we struggle through that chanting, we do all right, and then over time, in many things that we do, we do develop this lovely sense of a community coming together, and I certainly have seen that with this translated chanting that we have. We have the Pali and the English. In England, we introduced that, and it was all difficult to chant it and felt a bit clumsy and awkward and all that. We just kept at it, and then now when you hear all those voices together and you have a good leader, that helps. He's got a good voice, it's really lovely. It's kind of a really lovely thing to hear. And in many things that we're doing here, we're learning how to do them. I was just thinking as we're doing these eight precepts, this eight precept ceremony has been going on in Sri Lanka for 2,250 years.
Wow.
You know, and that's a tradition that we are a part of, and which is, I find that quite inspiring to see, we have this long lineage, and we're learning the etiquette, and we're learning the body language, and we're learning the chanting, and all of that, and it's there's a kind of privilege in that, I think, because it's quite fresh still, isn't it? It's not something that you just do because your culture does it. It's something you have to do, and you have to think about it, and you have to get it. Figure out how to do it. So there's a kind of lovely freshness to it, and I'm sure we'll all have very good memories of this someday. The way that we organize a monastery isn't the only way. The Burmese monasteries are organized a little bit different than the Thai monasteries are organized a little bit different than the Sri Lankan, organized very different than the Tibetan or a Zen monastery. Each of those has their own particular style. We have our style. Say this afternoon, the meditation, I noticed that 3/4 of the people were really tired, really exhausted, and so there was a lot of falling about. And I thought, well, maybe we should just go have a sleep. Probably just as good for everyone, but we kind of soldiered on. And so our tradition, say, around sleepiness, it's like you've got to figure out how to do it. We don't have any backslappers getting around with so that's, some people prefer a little slap in the back with a stick. Some people don't like it. You know, so it's not that this is the best tradition, right? It's not, you know, it's not the only way to do it. But that's not the point of it. I don't think the point of it is to make the best and most efficient, because I don't think that exists, actually. And sometimes that's how people kind of perceive something. Well, we could do, you know, we could do better chanting or different chanting, or we could have a monitor walking around and kind of poking us every time we fell asleep, or you know, all kinds of ways you could do it, and you can improve it and all of that. But the idea that you're ever going to get a form or a structure perfect is delusion. It's just part of the foreground. We do the best we can, but not to look for perfection in that which is always imperfect. You know, not to look perfection in a teacher, or in a system, or in a monastery, or in the vocalization of our chanting. It's an ichdukanata. It's unsure, it's unsatisfactory, it can't really fulfill you. But we can try, might as well give it a go. And I think it's in the trying and the sensitivity to each other that that you get a sense of a vehicle rolling on, because it rolls on from a sense of letting go into it rather than trying to get it the way you want to get it. In monasticism and the lay participation in monasticism, it's not something you're going to, if I have an agenda, I'm going to get something out of this experience for me. Usually you really suffer. You really suffer. If the attitude is one, well, how can I be sensitive to a group? How can I tune in to what's going on? And then how can I serve by being passive, by being active, or whatever? That's where you get a lot of joy out of the life. And then within that, of course, we face things we dislike and frictions, people who we find difficult, and we grow through that, of course. It's the manure of the Bodhi tree. Now, the theme of today's talk I was given is from the American Express. And this is an advert which I found by my new light switch. And the quote, I think most of you have seen this, it says, and it's got the picture of a rather delicious looking
dessert. It's a
dessert.
Pie.
It looks like a Christmas pie with just this fruit. With white cream and raspberries. Okay. And it says, and there's someone with a spoon about to dig in. This is important. And it says, what fun is a craving if you don't indulge in it? Okay, this is the question. What fun is a craving if you don't indulge in it? You could paraphrase it. What fun is a craving if you do indulge in it? Mm-hmm. You could take that. So this in this sense, this would be in Pali. It's called kama tanha, sensual craving. And the Buddhist teaching, of course, is the cessation of craving, rather than it's about Nibbana, or liberation, is about the cessation of craving rather than the gratification of craving. And of course what American Express is saying is to go for the gratification of craving, because then you'll spend more money and you'll use their credit card. But the gratification of craving, of course, the Buddha suggests is the source of suffering. Because if I don't find a way of being at peace with the varieties of sense experience as they present themselves, then I'm always needing to do something about it. And this reflection we did this morning: I'm of the nature to age, I have not gone beyond aging. I'm of the nature to sick, and I have not gone beyond sickness. I'm of the nature to die, I have not gone beyond dying. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. I am the owner of my karma, heir to my karma, etc. When you really reflect on that, and then you reflect on hedonism, or on this movement always out towards a sense experience, and you contemplate death, and you bring those two contemplations together, then the movement always towards sense happiness becomes inadequate, at least. You find this when someone dies in the family. I have someone I just know among our friends has just found out his cancer, right? And totally unexpected. Never really practiced much Dharma, all of a sudden got 6 months to live. Now, then you read that, what fun is a craving if you don't indulge in it? Seems absolutely stupid. What would a bit of fruitcake do for you if you just found out you were going to die in 6 months? You just, you know, you wouldn't be interested, unless you're really dumb. Right? And in a sense, that's what that reflection that we're chanting, you know, the Buddha's sort of shocking you into saying, well, what are you doing? Are you just, is life really a, are you a fruitcake? is this what the whole point of it, right? So, not that eating fruitcakes is wrong or all of that, but the goal of the spiritual life is really the deepest kind of fulfillment, and it's a very difficult one to realize, because it's almost counterintuitive, because our habitual mind believes in craving so much. You know, it believes in seeking some object to fulfill us, whether it's some food or a relationship or physical comfort or an idea or knowledge or some object that can fulfill us. And what the Buddha is saying is that whenever you feel a sense of lack, whenever you are not fulfilled, question the very strategy of seeking an object, seeking a person, seeking food, seeking music, seeking ideas. Is that really going to put an end to that sense of lack, or is it just going to gratify it for a period of time? In our culture, it emphasizes compensation and gratification rather than liberation. And that's much more difficult. Liberation, it's easy to eat a piece of cake. But to actually watch the mind which is feeling a sense of lack, to watch the mind which is unfulfilled, and to bear awareness of that, to observe that, to observe the discomfort of that, and to watch that cease, is a liberation from need. And so we're in our Buddhist practice, we're doing something which is so counterculture. If you think about it, we're taking the very material of suffering, craving, not having what you want and having what you don't want, and we're beginning to understand that sense of lack so thoroughly that we never get fooled by it. And this takes a lot of patience. It takes a lot of patience to, you know, like this afternoon, people are really tired, right? And just about we saw, you've been working so hard, so there's nothing wrong with being tired. And yet, you still came, and you kind of, you know, people are struggling with their dullness. Now that takes a lot of courage to do that. Now someone would say, well, that's stupid, why don't you just go and, you know, go slope off. But the path of liberation isn't necessarily the path of least resistance. It's not like just taking the easy way out. It is about being in being challenged by these different, you know, when we're out of our comfort zone. So like, let's say with feeling dull and feeling sleepy, the craving is just to maybe go somewhere else and lie down and sleep. I found that when we did our vigils in Thailand, we do an all-night vigil every lunar quarter, and I'd get so grumpy. I'd be so irritated at everyone. And then I'd start to complain and say, well, I want to go to sleep, and this is stupid, and I need my sleep. This kind of mind, because it wasn't getting what it wanted. You know, it wasn't getting the comfort of my wooden floor for the time that I wanted it. And it was actually very edifying to see what happened to me when that very natural comfort of sleeping, which you need to sleep, I mean, you need to sleep, there's nothing wrong with that, but just being challenged in that way and seeing what that brought up into my mind, seeing the kind of aversion to it, I don't want to do this, and the rationalizing mind, the complaining mind, was actually very instructive. Now, I'm going to get that when I die. You know, I'm going to get feelings which I'm not going to be able to run away from. I'm going to get sensations and all kinds of stuff when we're sick, where you can't fall asleep to it. You're stuck with your pain, you're stuck with your discomfort. And if I've never trained with that, then every time discomfort and pain or whatever comes and I feel grumpy, I don't understand myself. I don't really fully understand myself. So the craving mind, in this sense, kama tanha, seeking comfort, sweetness, fulfillment in that level, and the hedonistic mind, the mind which is always sensually engaged, if you notice that it always is kind of looking for something to satisfy, and what we're looking at is that very need. And if you can just step back and see, well, there's no object that's ever going to satisfy it. No object will ever satisfy it. You begin to, oh, there's nowhere to go. I'm home. You let go. But if you really believe that the craving mind can find an object of satisfaction, then you're on the treadmill. You're always in objective consciousness looking for something which will satisfy and fulfill you. But if you see there's no object which can fulfill you, ultimately, it can gratify you short term, and that's the difficulty. And that's the in the teaching it says that the difficulty with samsara is that the craving can satisfy you on the short term, but it can't fulfill you in the long term. So, am I willing to give up short term gratification for long-term fulfillment? Am I willing to maybe face my fears, which are uncomfortable, which are difficult to look at? Am I willing to abide with awareness with them and bear with that discomfort until the fear ceases? Or every time the fear comes up, do I run away to a distraction? Fear comes up into consciousness, I can run away from it and that'll feel comfortable, right? I feel comfortable, but every time I come into that situation the same fear comes up, I'm stuck. But if I face my fears and I say, this is what fear feels like, it's very uncomfortable, it doesn't fulfill my craving mind, but as I witness to fear and fear ceases, I realize the cessation of fear and the cessation of wanting. So I have a deeper kind of peace, a deeper kind of fulfillment, but I have to forego the short-term satisfaction. Huh? And the simile, of course, is the skin disease, which the Buddha talks about and I talk about. And it's like poison ivy. You have poison ivy. Everyone had poison ivy here? Poison ivy. Poison ivy is in Canada, you must learn, if you walk in the forest, there's a three-leaf, triangular-leaf vine, which is called poison ivy, and if you rub that, if you pick that up, right, it has an oil in it, and that oil causes blisters to form, yeah? And we all know that, we all had it, and the blisters, right, they itch. And so your craving mind is, well, scratch it. And anyone who's had poison ivy, you know, when you scratch it, it feels good. Mm-hmm. Short-term satisfaction, right? But anyone who's had poison ivy, you know, you scratch it and it starts to run up your arm. And you know you're going to have to practice restraint on scratching if you're going to be free from the disease, right? So that's kind of counterintuitive, because you're intuitive, oh, just scratch it. And it does feel good, right? The Buddha said, yes, scratching does feel good. He's not saying that it feels bad necessarily, but it won't put an end to the disease. And that's the problem we have, that scratching does feel good, but the disease doesn't end. So what we watch is itching, scratching, and we watch that, there's the itching again. And at some point in our cycles of itching and scratching, the wisdom arises, the determination arises, the patience arises, all these different factors arises to say, I'm not going to scratch. And then we change our mind, scratch. And we go through that quite a few times until we really want to be free from this disease. So if you've had it with poison ivy, you know, you've really you've just got her all over yourself, and you get, okay, so you take calamine lotion and you have steroids or whatever you use, but you have to stop scratching, don't you? You have to stop. And there is, this thing arises you. Now, why does that determination arise in you? Not because you feel guilty about itching and scratching. It's not guilt, it's wisdom. I'm going to be really sick if I don't stop doing this. Right? And it's the same with our patterns of fear, or our patterns of worry, or our patterns of distraction, or our patterns of hatred, or whatever it is. That it's a similar kind of a model that you can use for all the kinds of delusions in the mind. You feel, let's say, you feel just say something like doubt. That's a very tricky one, because we like to think, but to actually feel the sense of doubt, usually you want to read something to get past your doubt, or you ask a teacher something, which is okay. We can use doubt, but to actually have the sense of not being sure, Ajahn Chah, am I an arahant? Ajahn Chah, am I Sotapatti, right? And Ajahn Chah says, are you? And so to actually have, like, to not know, and that's very uncomfortable, right? To not be sure, what's the future going to be like? Is it going to be okay? That's uncomfortable. We can plan and all that, but actually, to not scratch that, to just say, oh, this is what it feels like not to be sure, then you begin to have awareness of doubt, rather than always to know, always to have an idea. Not that I'm dismissing the need, the validity of ideas, but to not know, to not be sure. Or to feel lonely, say. If you feel really, really lonely, and to abide. Now, loneliness, you can phone your friends, you can do what you want. Loneliness is as it is. But to actually just feel loneliness is this way. What's the itching and scratching? Well, it's very uncomfortable to feel lonely, isn't it? So, and it's okay to alleviate loneliness with friends, but to actually once in a while to actually bear witness to the very feeling of loneliness, and what's the itching there, and what's the scratching, and what's the result, or to feel uninspired, say, and I'd like to be in a monastery and to not like the abbot, or not like the Dhamma talk, right? And just to feel the sense of, oh, I don't really like this, and not leave. And not hate the teacher. And not feel guilty because you don't like it, but say, oh, this is what it feels like to be utterly bored. Right? And not go anywhere with it. Like, when you're feeling utterly bored, you know, probably been there too. That the mind just then wanders off, doesn't it? Starts thinking, when is this going to be over? And I want to go to sleep. But to actually come back to the moment and not need to be entertained. This is one of the things you have to learn in the monastery. You will not be entertained. But to actually, to just be here for the sake of being here. Rather than having kind of scintillating, fascinating discussions, and just to kind of, this is what it feels like to be bored. And when you feel bored, if you're used to a kind of interest and excitement, then of course the scratching mind looks for something. It wants something. So then your scratching mind might hate the teacher. And you're going, well, shut up. This is just going to go on and on and on. So if you have like Lama Zopa apparently gives 7-hour talks.
Oh my.
7 hours, you imagine that?
Talk for 7 hours? My God.
But if you're practicing awareness, then you understand what that's about. If you're practicing wanting to be entertained, then of course different. But so to kind of really see what is this work about, it's like all sensual experience is as it is. Some sensual experience we find entertaining, gratifying, fulfilling, and we like it. Some sensual experience we find boring, unentertaining, we don't like it, right? So the craving mind, its strategy is like and dislike. The Buddha is saying that that's a strategy for restlessness, because like and dislike will always come and go. And so we come to this very constant teaching, is that with contact there is feeling, with feeling there's whether there is craving, with craving there's attachment. And this is happening all the time. So if you're sitting in meditation and you're feeling discomfort, right there craving arises with the discomfort. And if you can know that craving to move, and you bear witness to the craving, and the craving ceases, you realize nirodha, the cessation of craving. And you found peace with discomfort. Not because you made yourself comfortable, but because you found a way to transcend discomfort. You found a way out of it, not by scratching it, but by knowing it. And by knowing the craving, and by watching the craving cease. And that's different. And that's liberation. So the same, like if you, like the kind of the negative things that come up between us as human beings, kind of there may be something that I do the way I or I don't do right. You're going to find irritating. And to kind of expect me to always be someone who doesn't, that can always fulfill you, would be ridiculous. So at times, I know it's very rare, you're going to find something I do irritating, like, right? Now what do you do with that? Like, do you then, what does your mind do with that? Do you kind of analyze me and peg me in some psychological place? Or do you feel you shouldn't feel irritated at me? Or do you just kind of start to spin negative thought? Or do you know irritation feels this way? And then what? And just know it, and just watch irritation go to the silence of the mind. Then it's neutral. It's neutral, right? And we're going to be doing that all the time with each other as human beings. This is life. You do something I like, you do something I dislike. And community life is, of course, of taking the challenge of living with a group of people and not just abiding by like and dislike. You know, finding something more profound, like the Dhamma. So then the kind of constant practice in a monastery or in life is to continually come back to that place of knowing craving and watching it cease. Knowing craving, watching it cease. Knowing craving, that. I notice a lot of people are holding their yawns. They're really struggling, right? Now, if I was really brave, I would give a 7-hour talk. But I don't have the courage to do that, right? But I certainly remember these long talks that Ajahn Chah gave. And to actually, like, one of the things that's very edifying in monastic life is you get repetition. Right, you get the same people, you get the same patterns of social activity, and you get very similar reactions. So if you have a very judging mind, right, and your mind's very judgmental, so and there's a routine that we have to fulfill, and your mind's very judging about how we should eat and how quiet we should be and all of that, then your mind's just going to start to pick on people in a judging way. That's what it's going to do. That's what it's conditioned to do. It doesn't matter who comes, the judging mind's going to do that. You begin to see it's not about her or him or the monks, it's actually about the judging mind, the mind which is always critical and finding fault. And you begin to see, that's the problem, it's the mind. It's the mind is the problem, it's not them, it's not me, it's just that it's the way the mind is conditioned. And you begin to use the repetition of monastic life to watch the judging mind. You begin to understand the judging mind, how it works. How it's always, you know, creating people, judging them, and how I create myself through that judgment. and how I actually like that, how my mind actually likes to go there and do that. So you're studying your own mind, aren't you? You're studying how your mind works, its likes and dislikes. And you're studying it, we're studying it within a very, very fixed kind of routine. You know, you morning chanting, evening chant, this is what you do. And that's great, because then we don't have the option to change the schedules. I have the option to change the schedules. So you have the schedule, which, you know, we kind of set up and we run for 20 years. And we alter it a little bit. And then everyone gives up to it. And then you watch, liking, disliking, liking, disliking. So, morning meditation. You want to come to morning meditation? Fine. Come to morning meditation. You don't want to come to morning meditation? Fine. Come to morning meditation. Right? Now, if you just follow preferences, you know, morning meditation, well, how do I feel today? No, I think I'll give it a miss. Yeah, there's going to be no strength there. You'd just be a wimp, won't you? I should come to morning meditation, and you've worked for 14 hours. No, you shouldn't come to morning meditation. You should actually sleep. Right? So you're using wisdom to see what's right here. What's right here? Like, rather than think, I always should come to morning meditation, or I should only come to morning meditation when I feel like it. No. What's right? Morning meditation is right, but I'm sick, I got the flu. Right? So you don't come to morning meditation. So it's a mature, it's not like a police state. You know, I'm going to, you know, no, not me, married, no. We'll get Alan. Alan's going to kind of, going to go around all the rooms tomorrow, make sure you wake up. Then we'd be full of fear, wouldn't we? Be awful, you know, the police state. Who didn't come to morning? I could do a checklist before we start meditation. Okay, let me see. Lawrence didn't come. No breakfast for Lawrence, right? No breakfast. Then you just live in fear, and some places do that. They coerce you to do whatever's supposed to be done out of fear, and that's awful, and it's immature. So you know, we have this form and structure, and we try to give up to it the best we can, and when we can't, we look at our own minds. Why? Well, I'm sick, I can't come. But then, normal course of events, you can come to more, and then you watch, liking it, disliking it, being bored with it, being interested in it. So you get beyond interest and boredom, like and dislike, and your mind begins to find peace. Why does it find peace? Because it's no longer picking and choosing according to craving. If I wake up in the morning and I just come to meditations because of my craving mind, that's not going to make me peaceful. But if I come because, no, I'm just going to give up to this, then I can watch the craving mind. And that's the beauty of a disciplined life, is that you have the freedom to watch craving rather than to follow it. And that's a different kind of freedom. And it's quite interesting. Say, I know with the people that I've lived with in monasteries, you kind of end up sitting beside someone because they ordained before you or just after you. Yeah, so you're just there with them. You like them someday, you don't like them someday, and you're not there to establish an intimate relationship with them. It's just, they're there. And it's great. It's really, really good, because the only expectation is that you live by the precepts. So kind of I was very fortunate. I had Ajahn Anando on one side, and Ajahn Brahm on the other side. Right? And I'm very fortunate to have these chaps. I felt quite intimidated by them sometimes. Two powerful guys, and I feel really intimidated sometimes. Okay, this is what intimidation feels like. Then I try to mimic them. No, that's not going to work. You can still feel intimidated, but okay, this is what. So you have people around you, and that brings stuff up. Brings up like and dislike, brings up fear, brings up judgment, it brings up inspiration, it brings up boredom, you know, all kinds of stuff, and great. You watch the whole array of self views coming up, and all you have to do is abide as the background. Simple. But what happens is you choose the foreground, and what chooses the foreground is craving. Attachment to craving. And craving is always trying to get it right in the foreground. You get burnt. And you step back into the background. This is the way it is now. The background, this is the way it is now. Just that way. And then you see what the craving mind is creating, like, dislike. So the craving mind is very deluding, and enslavement to it is profound suffering, isn't it? Because a craving mind can never really, really ever be fulfilled. And it's not just about craving for cake. It's the craving to be someone, and also the craving to get rid of. So it's a very, very important energy to understand. And the energy is understood when you see, whenever you feel a sense of lack. You know, whenever there's anything, there's a sense of inadequacy or there's a lack in some way, that's dukkha. Right? And that's what you have to understand. And as the dukkha arises, then you see, well, what, why? Why does it arise? Because I want something I don't have, or I have something I don't want, right? And it's that wanting that if you get a hold of it, that's the itching. And that's the itching. And then you have a choice. You can scratch it, or you can watch it, right? Oh, you can scratch it and watch it. So if you're going to scratch it, at least watch it. And if you watch it, what's the result? Is the result really what you expected, or does it go to another itching? And if it goes to another itching, then say, watch it. And if you can't watch it and you want to scratch it, then watch it. And then at some point, in this restless cycle called samsara, you're going to see, this is endlessly restless. One itching leads to a scratching, leads to another itching, leads to another scratching. At some point, you're going to read the teaching and say, the cessation of craving is truly peaceful. The cessation of craving, not the gratification of craving. And then you have the willingness to forbear and pay witness unfulfilled craving. And unfulfilled craving, when it's witnessed, ceases. And that's what Nirodha and Nibbana are about. It's the cessation of craving. And that takes fortitude. You know, for me to bear witness to some kind of a fear which I don't want to look at, well, that's really hard to do. And if I've run away from it, or some kind of loneliness which I don't want to look at, or to take responsibility for aversion that I have, rather than blame it on someone else, that takes a lot of fortitude and courage and forbearance to look at that. And that's what we're doing. We're quite often looking or feeling these things and letting them cease in the mind. Now, notice like the cultivation of the Brahma Viharas, like the cultivation of metta, the cultivation of mudita, the cultivation of compassion, they're not based on craving, if you think about it, right? The cultivation of metta isn't something I do out of greed or because I want to become something. It's something which comes from a different kind of energy. It's not like an ego energy. The cultivation of the awake mind, the ability, the capacity just to say, this is the way it is now, to remember this moment. That's not from craving. If it is from craving, you're not looking. Right? But to actually just open the mind and say, well, I'm really bored. To cultivate that awakening mind isn't from craving. You can mistake it and try. You can use awareness to try to get something, but you're not on the path. But to this continual awakening of the mind, when you're trying to fall asleep, that doesn't come from wanting any particular thing. And this is where people make a mistake in the path, is they cultivate awareness, or they think what is awareness, in order to get something, and they're not aware of that very desire to get something. Whereas letting go with awareness is just this way. There's no craving in it. There's no becoming in it. There's no trying to get rid of it. So I think everyone's pretty... You've worked quite hard this week. You're all tired, so maybe I'll finish it there. So Marion's going to do that. Handamayang.
Sadhu Karam Dadamase. Sadhu, sadhu.
let's finish with that chant we were doing. I am of the nature to age. Now let's do the sharing of blessings. Isn't that appropriate? Let's do that. Let's see it. Now let us chant the verses of sharing and aspiration. Through the goodness that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent, or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless. Through the goodness that arises from my practice and through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease, and all harmful states of mind, until I realize
nirvana, every kind of birth. May I have an upright mind,
with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge. Unsurpassed is the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble lord. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled.
And the closing homage of 24.
Arahaṁ sammā sambuddho bhagavā, the Lord, the perfectly enlightened and blessed one, Bhūtāṁ bhagavantāṁ abhivādemi. I render homage to the Buddha, the Blessed One. Sawakato Bhagavata Dhammo, the teaching so completely explained by him, Dhammam Namasami, I bow to the Dhamma.
Supatipanno
bhagavato savakasangho, the Blessed One's disciples who have practiced well, sangham namami, I bow to the Sangha.